Welcome back to Equals. This is Max.
Welcome to Equals, everyone. This is Naf.
Naf, it's me and you again. Two podcasts in a row. How exciting.
Yeah, I don't know if I would say exciting. To be honest, it's a bit of a shame because I really love working with Nabil. I think I need to devise a way, you know, to do the next podcast with him.
Ah, okay. Why is that?
I think he's so much more organized, Max. He's, you know, always coming up with the questions way ahead of time. He's preparing a brief. I actually learned that there's a brief for this podcast from him. But that said, Max, I have to give you your more relaxed, which I really love.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, Nan.
But on a serious note, Max, I don't know, maybe it's because it's spring and I'm feeling philosophical. You know, I've been really thinking, do you feel like the world is in a better place in terms of social justice, you know, in terms of equality? I'm thinking, you know, from gender to race to class, as a society, how much are we advancing or how much are we moving backwards?
Well, certainly the kind of mainstream story, and which is, you know, based on fact, extreme poverty is reduced dramatically in the last 20 or 30 years. It's kind of stalled since 2020, but, you know, still the drop in the last 20, 30 years is huge. And also we've seen, you know, by various measures, big improvements in the rights of women, whether it's the number of women in the workforce or, you know, the closing of the gender pay gap, better legislation. Still a huge way to go. I think everyone would agree on that. But I think that the feeling is we've seen progress on gender too during this kind of neoliberal economic period, if you like. And that's what today's podcast is about, isn't it?
Yes, Max. And I'm really looking forward to explore these issues. We have a fantastic guest, Bhumika Muchhala. She's a development and feminist economist. She also works with the Third World Network as a political economist and senior advisor.
Yes, great. It was a really interesting interview. And let's listen to it.
Let's listen to it. Bhumika, let's think about powerful women in the current economic system. Famous women leaders in the global economy, say, for instance, Christine Lagarde, the former head of the IMF, someone you have personally engaged with, I imagine. And now she's the head of the European Central Bank, who regularly say, you know, that they are passionate feminists. Do you think they are?
My answer would be an unequivocal no. There is always a very sharp difference between the word feminist that's coming from the lens of the global south versus that would coming from the north. In the south, feminism does have roots in an internationalism that is structural, that is decolonial. And so then it's quite the opposite force field from these feminists who characterize a sort of second wave feminism, or perhaps even worse, a sort of lean in corporate feminism. So in that sense, a feminist lens from the South seeks to interrogate, unsettle, and ultimately dismantle power dynamics that are constructed within a colonial, patriarchal, and capitalist order of the economy and of society. These women are quite the opposite. They uphold the agenda of neoliberal financialization, the turn in the 1970s towards privatization, liberalization, and deregulation, which is upheld by a neoclassical economic ideology where, you know, at the center of this ideology is the political and economic regime of austerity, which these women have been responsible for propagating and internationalizing, either imposed through the IMF or internalized through the financial system at large. And this also is about the structural design of a world economy that they are very much involved in upholding. And this is a political economy that systematically extracts and exploits from the global south and from vulnerable communities for the accumulation, protection, and power of the rich and the North, and in particular, the rich in the North. So the thing that I would also emphasize is that they are invested in maintaining this unequal balance of power that we have today between debtor and creditor. And that is essentially what the International Monetary Fund especially is very much at the center of.
So effectively, to say you're a neoliberal feminist is basically a contradiction in your view.
I would say so, unless it's really about on the white collar level, needing women to, you know, meaning that women would basically, in many ways, mimic men. That is the lean in corporate feminism, or the sort of, you know, representational politics, which is very much the essence of identity politics, where it's about, you know, diversity, diversifying your leadership, but not really changing the actual structure and the terms of power relations or the terms of social relations within your company or within your university. So it's great to have women, it's great to have female leadership, it's great to have female presidents of universities and chairs of you know, corporate boards, but is the university or corporation as a whole actually upholding feminist principles that are rooted in shifting power relations, creating an environment that is more equitable? And by that, I would also like to emphasize, feminist is not only about women, it is about intersectional inequalities. So I think it also very much encompasses the intersections of gender and race, class, ethnicity, nationalism. It's not as limited as just gender expression or the biological gender, chosen gender expression.
If Lagarde was here, she would probably say, I suspect, that the last 40 years has seen, you know, kind of, to some extent, the liberation of women and the much, much greater participation of women in the workforce, you know, getting out from under the control of their husbands, you know, the gap in pay between women and men has begun to close. We've got lots more legislation and protection of women in the workplace. I mean, she would almost certainly agree that it's not nearly enough. There's much further to go, as would other, you know, the World Economic Forum with their gender pay gap report. And, you know, these are all basically neoliberals, but who've going to quite some depth to say that the last 40 years has been good for women. What do you think about that? What would you say to them about that?
I'll start with labor participation and say women's labor force participation is not the same as economic justice for women and girls. Within the international financial institutions, the UN, and in particular the IMF and World Bank, women are oftentimes mentioned most vigorously when it comes to, you know, what they call female labor force participation. And we've even seen private financial giants like BlackRock claim feminist credentials by, you know, similarly emphasizing women's right to paid work and participation in markets more generally. However, this emphasis on labor force participation, it ignores the deep linkages between unpaid and paid work, and it neglects the troubling implications of increasing this access to labor markets when those markets only provide underpaid work under substandard laboring conditions. There's nothing ethical or feminist about creating economic conditions that force women into indecent jobs, intensifying their double burdens with unpaid care labor at home, as well as lack of living wage work in the workforce. So this claim to care about females' work participation and closing the gender employment gap is, you know, taking place within, again, a larger system that has structurally failed working women. And one of the key ways it has really structurally failed them is that of gendered austerity. The entire effect of austerity measures, particularly public expenditure contraction, which happens in the public and civil employment sectors where women in developing countries most heavily rely on, or regressive taxation, which impacts poor women the hardest. This is what impacts women. This is what impacts the material life world of women, and, you know, essentially turns them into the absorbers of the economic shock. So in this way, it is quite hypocritical to talk about the labor participation when, you know, the larger context, the larger air that we're in, that women are situated in, is one that systematically forces negative and adverse impacts on them.
Really important point, Bhumika. It also feels to me, I think, you know, one of the big differences looking at the workplace between standard progressive campaigning for a living wage, better jobs, decent work, is this integral understanding of reproductive economy, unpaid care. You know, the relationship between unpaid and paid elements of the economy. What's your take on this?
Yeah, the unpaid economy, we also call it the social reproductive economy, right? And social reproduction is defined as a non-market economy of social provisioning. So essentially, everything that maintains life of everything that maintains human lives, the reproduction of people, their care, their socialization, their education, their birth, it's intergenerational, it's interdependent, it's about the daily provisioning of services. The value of unpaid care work performed by women globally in 2019 was calculated at approximately 11 trillion, and it may still be an underestimation. But the point is this, 11 trillion quantifies the scale of the subsidy that unpaid care work provides to the world economy, reproducing and sustaining human beings for free. And yet care work is absent from conventional measures of economic production, such as gross domestic product, GDP. Further still, most world cultures do not even view women's unpaid labor as labor, but as quote-unquote love, or quote-unquote the natural biological role of women. So there's sort of an idea of the three R's in unpaid care economy or social reproductive economy. And these three R's are recognition, reduction, and redistribution.
Okay, so let's break that down. So you've got, first of all, from an economics point of view, recognizing that you've got this enormous amount of work that is done primarily by women, day in, day out, that is generally not counted, that it's kind of invisible, if you like. So that would be the recognition?
Yes, certainly. The recognition of the enormous subsidy transfer. And, you know, this harks back to arguments in the 1970s, right, where a sort of Marxist analysis talked about how women and nature sort of serve the same role of endless and free use value. So,
oh, that's interesting. So kind of women's labor is a bit like the environment. It's like a kind of huge subsidy to the formal economy, but it's kind of invisible. Okay, that's really helpful comparison. So if you were then going to redistribute that, what would that look like?
Redistribution is not just about sort of in the household agreeing for men to take on more, but it's also about legal frameworks, social norms that today keep women in their place as subordinated and expropriated workers in the household. And this is not about saying that all women are being forced to do care work. It's not at all about that. It's about a larger analysis of the role of women in the society, in the economy, right? It's also linking the role in the house to the role in the larger economy. So redistribution is more specifically about the sustenance of the social infrastructure in the economy. It is about the public services, public goods. It is about decent work. It is about quality education. It is about progressive taxation. It's about all the core structural economic issues that would support the life world of women and girls, especially on the intersections of inequality.
Bhumika, I would love for us to talk now about the link between anti-colonialism, anti-sexist movements. we talk more now about colonialism, no? And the ways in which the global north continues to extract resources, profits from the global south. And there is a strong movement now demanding the global economy be decolonized. We have had quite a few podcasts on this topic recently. So in your work and in the work of other thinkers in this field, these two adjectives, feminist and decolonial, are now used together. What is the link between the two in your mind? And how do these two struggles against sexism and against colonialism fit together?
Thanks. This is a great question. For me, in my view, feminist is decolonial. As I said earlier, from a global South lens, feminism is structural, it's internationalist, it's inherently anti-colonial, and it is about power and about linking the current present to past legacies of colonial history. So feminist is decolonial. And in this sense, it is about an approach to the collective sovereignty of those at the intersections of inequality, but also about collective sovereignty for the global South at large. Decolonial is about three key entry points, among others, but I will touch upon three. One is about what kind of knowledge are we influenced and made by? How is our economy structured? And what's the history we're coming from? So in terms of looking at knowledge structures or knowledge systems, I would say neoclassical economics, or what we know today as neoliberalism, has indeed the characteristics of economic colonialism in that it claims a universality, even though its origins are in the provincialism of Europe, but it's applied globally. It has, it incorporates the language of modernism, and it is inherently technical and quantitative to the degree that it often ignores the life experiences and even the empirical realities on the ground. So in that sense, you know, neoliberal economics is about a hierarchy of knowledge, where this one form of economics is ascribed with, rigor and relevance and legitimacy, while other forms of economic knowledge are silenced, obscured, marginalized, to the point where they're not even taught in most universities. They're not in the mainstream discourse. And I'm talking about heterodox economics and feminist economics, especially heterodox feminist economics, but also about ecological and dependency, about structuralist and developmentalist, and about indigenous ways of knowing, being, and doing. So when we're talking about decolonial, we're really talking about counteracting this injustice of the hegemonic and singular knowledge system that we are taught and exposed to in economics.
I can see how the global South is more likely to be interested in heterodox economics, but is there not a case for the fact there are lots of people in the global North who are very interested in heterodox economics and would have the same critique of neoliberalism? I suppose I don't necessarily understand the equation of a fight for heterodox economics and a fight for decolonialism being exactly the same thing. You know, you could have a fight, surely, for heterodox economics within the UK or the US or within Europe. And in fact, we do. So
the link of knowledge systems to decolonial is exactly that. It is it's the focus on neoliberal economics that also upholds the neocolonial global reality. So in that sense, it's not about heterodox economics only being applicable or interested or interesting to the South. It is absolutely universally relevant, but it's about locating how neoliberal economics is a key driver. It drives the thinking and the conditioning that shapes our unequal world economy, in particular, upholding these metrics and assumptions and indicators. So for example, neoliberal economics upholds, you know, the metrics of gross domestic product, or the metric of debt limits. It also upholds these assumptions of crowding out and market confidence. These sorts of assumptions and metrics are inherent to what is happening with, you know, financialization and the ways in which Global South countries prioritize debt servicing over and above their health, economic, or climate financing needs. So when we're talking about decolonizing the global economy, it needs to start with the ways in which Global South economies and societies are thinking about the economy, the ways in which it's become almost... it's almost become second nature to just accept this assumption called crowding out, right? And it's an assumption that government spending crowds out or deters private investments, in large part by driving up domestic interest rates. This assumption discounts the consequences of economic recession. It ignores exacerbated social inequalities. And paradoxically, it is not even related to the actual evidence. The IMF itself has published on something called fiscal multipliers, which is that the more the more government invests in social spending, the more it uplifts the gross domestic product indicator. And this is the sort of ideological juice that most Global South governments have been drinking.
That's a good one, the neoliberal ideological juice. And Bhumika, you were clearly outlining the Global South movement's contribution in terms of decolonizing the global economy. But you know, it's different movements coming together to fight for justice, no? And I was wondering, how's that feminist?
Again, feminist is not about, you know, sprinkling woman and gender in a isolationist fashion. So let's get to the hot topic of political economy today, which is the historic debt crisis that the Global South is in. To say that gender and debt are disconnected is like saying, you know, oxygen and human survival. I mean, it's absolutely at the core. We need to gender the debt crisis. It is precisely women who embody the debt of the state. The reality of debt is precisely that resources and well-being are subtracted from women's lives, you know, for the primacy given to repayment of the richest creditors and lenders in our world economy.
That's an amazing description of what feminism stands for. What will be the next frontier, Bhumika, you know, the next progressive step for feminism? What would bring you reassurance and hope?
So I think in terms of next steps, it's hard not to mention the so-called green transition and all the ways in which the green transition, rooted in a long history of ecological colonialism, and the very real ongoing and future danger of women and other marginalized communities being disposable and dispensable fodder in the green transition. So going forward, I think it is really, how do we address the, you know, the systemic imbalance and structural inequalities that women and girls are centered in within the climate transition, within the climate crisis or the climate emergency. What does it mean in terms of how public services and public goods need to be, you know, radically reoriented? What does it mean in terms of how economic policies and the very macro design of our societies have to be radically reimagined? What does it mean for governance in the institutions that set the norms? What does it mean for South-South cooperation and solidarity? Can we now start really addressing the need for debtors' unions or, you know, borrowers' clubs to enhance the leverage and the bargaining power of Global South countries when it comes to the debt subordination Can we start talking about South-South cooperation in critical raw minerals that would counter the ways in which the minerals and natural resources of the South are going to be systematically extracted for the needs of the green transition in the North? So these are sort of the very feminist questions in framing a decolonial and internationalist global Green New Deal.
Thank you so much, Bhumika. Yeah, I agree with you. That is definitely the next frontier. And thanks for a really, really fascinating interview.
Thank you so much, Bhumika. It's been incredible talking to you.
So, Naf, I mean, that interview was quite heavy academically, but it also really powerful. What does it say to you, you know, as a woman from the global South? You know, what does all of that kind of analysis mean in your lived experience?
I think really complicated, Max. You know, I was actually thinking about my mother, you know, my grandma. You know, when I think of my mom's generation, for instance, they were more socially and politically active because, you know, they're from a socialist generation. Therefore, you know, they're more socially and politically conscious. And when I think of my grandma's generation, they come from a more rural and from a more traditional setting. Yeah, we're talking in the context of Ethiopia. So when you compare these two generations, of course, there is advancement in terms of gender rights and equality. Now, you know, between my grandma and myself, of course, there's also a significant advancement in terms of gender rights. But I think understanding the political context is also important.
I think that's fascinating. It made me think of some years back with Oxfam, I met a group of garment workers in some of the factories in Myanmar, all young women. And, you know, we'd written a report exposing the terrible working conditions, you know, like 14-hour days, people being locked in factories, you know, fire hazards, fired if you get pregnant, you know, without any redress. And these young women were organizing first trade union. It's really inspiring. And I think, you know, if you ask them, did they feel their position as young women was better than that of their mothers and their grandmothers, then I think it would have been a pretty unequivocal yes. You know, despite the appalling conditions, they felt freer, they felt more empowered, you know, they felt more in charge of their own destinies. But at the same time, they felt passionately that it wasn't enough, that their labour standards were appalling, and indeed they were organising to fight for much, much better standards and with some success. And I think for me that kind of sums it all up, that yes, there has been some progress, but it's not enough, and the whole economic system seems to be pushing in the other direction, which is kind of what Bhumika was saying, wasn't she?
A really powerful example, by the way, Max. But, you know, another powerful point that Bhumika was saying that you touched upon is you can't be a neoliberal and at the same time a feminist, no? You're supporting an exploitative system, especially to women, to people of color, to working class people, to the poorest. So how can you be a feminist?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is really interesting. I'd love to know what Christine Lagarde would think of that. I think the kind of economic policies that she would support, whether it's, you know, reducing trade union power or, you know, the costs of labor or, you know, making it easier for privatizing services, austerity, cutting government budgets, all of those policies are like a massive neoliberal gale force wind kind of blowing in the face of anyone trying to make progress on gender equality. So there I would completely agree with Bhumika that, you know, it's like you say you want this to happen, but then all the economic policies that you support are pushing in the other direction. I do think it's the flip side is also really interesting, that policies that we would traditionally just call progressive, you know, say taxing the rich more or, you know, investing in public services, I think Bhumika and others are also trying to present those as feminist policies, you know, inherently feminist policies, in the same way that neoliberal policies are inherently sexist. And I think that's really useful too, because I think it really makes a powerful connection that these structural economic issues are also gender issues at the same time. And I thought that was really, really good point too.
Really powerful points, Max. That's, I think, a great point to end it on.
Yeah, I think it is. And next podcast is you're back with your favorite, Nabil.
Yes, yes, I cannot wait. So everyone, please join us next week.
Brilliant. See you next time, everyone.
Thank you, everyone. Bye.